And so you know where we are. We formulated the Klein-Gordon equation in general relativity in a Lagrangian form using an action and Euler Lagrange equations. Today, we'll use a Legendre transform to rewrite the theory in a Hamiltonian way, but still generally relativistically covariant, even though it won't look like it because time gets a special role in the Hamiltonian formalism. We know that the Legendre transform is a map that is invertible, and so it is obviously covariant because this is obviously covariant. And we will also, already today, start with a step four, the quantization. Remember the generally relativistically covariant Klein-Gordon equation. It looks like that. Where this complicated thing is the D'Alembert operator. It arises from the Klein-Gordon action, which is this. And from the Klein-Gordon action, you can actually quite easily reconstruct, if you don't remember by heart how the D'Alembert should look like, how it has to look like. Because basically, if you rewrite that action by using an integration by parts, so that this derivative on phi becomes a derivative not on phi, but on the rest of what is in the action, then you immediately see the D'Alembert appear. If you do an integration by parts, then instead of having a derivative acting on this phi, you have the derivative acting on this times that and that. Okay? And then in order to still have a square root of g in the integral measure, you can write as square root of g and divide by square root of g. And what you see then occurring here is phi, D'Alembert, and phi. See that? You do integration by part, this term becomes minus phi, D'Alembert, phi. So this may look very complicated, but ultimately, this is simply what you get when you do an integration by parts of one of those derivatives so that you get phi, some operator acting on phi. And that some operator, that is the D'Alembert. I think we sketched that last time already. So from the action, we can read off what the Lagrangian is. The action is this beautiful thing that treats space and time completely the same way. We have an R4 integration, or generally, if we have some non-trivial space-time manifold, which is not as a manifold isomorphic to R4, still we integrate over the entire manifold, not distinguishing between space and time. And we integrate this scalar to obtain overall and scalar. The Lagrangian is what you have to integrate over time to obtain the action. So we remove here the time integration, and we are left with only the spatial integration. That is then the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. And already we've treated time differently from space. Now we can do step three. We move from the Lagrangian formulation to the Hamiltonian formulation. So what we have here is a Lagrangian that contains the field phi, its spatial derivatives, and its temporal derivative. The temporal derivative is special when we go between Hamiltonians and Lagrangians, because it is the temporal derivative which we will Legendre the temporal derivative is the variable that we will Legendre transform. So we view the Lagrangian now as a function of phi and its time derivative and time, well, and of course space. But the space dependence and also the space derivatives are mere spectators in this business of doing a Legendre transform. So I'm not actually spelling out any space derivatives or space dependence. What matters for the Legendre transform with respect to the time derivative of phi is only time dependencies and time derivatives. So therefore, for the purpose of the Legendre transform, the important thing is that the Lagrangian up here depends on the field, its time derivative, and also on time.
This is comma zero, yes. That means the time derivative. Sometimes I will put a dot on it, sometimes I will write dt. Sorry, this is all synonymous. Yeah, sorry, it's a bit small here. And that's even smaller here. That's another zero derivative, comma zero.
So when we wrote the Lagrangian of curved space-time, wouldn't we replace the ordinary derivative by a covariant derivative? That means by semicolon.
Yeah, no, no. Well, it depends on the purpose that you have in mind. In many circumstances, if you want to derive from a special relativistic theory, a general relativistic theory, then you write it with ordinary derivatives and turn them into covariant derivatives. But that's not our purpose here now. We know that this theory that we started out with here, this theory here, is covariant. You see, this Klein-Gordon equation follows from that action. This action is a scalar. This equation, ds by d phi equals zero, is a scalar equation. It's completely independent of any choice of coordinate system. Therefore, this equation, which is that equation after all, completely independent of coordinate system. Everything is completely covariant. So we know our theory is covariant. It's completely independent of the coordinate system we choose, and so are its solutions. Therefore, we can now do really whatever we like with this thing, like, for example, removing the time derivative to the Lagrangian. We could now introduce a special time, 5 minutes after midnight, if we want. And then do a transformation that depends on that 5 minutes after midnight. It doesn't matter, because as long as we transform in an invertible way, we arrive at a formulation which may not look covariant at all, but we know it is, because it is transformable from the covariant theory. Okay? So working with the time derivative here may look like an odd thing to do, but it's totally legal. We could also work with, you know, the time derivative minus 7 times the second space derivative. It doesn't matter, because we transform it into another formulation which may not look covariant, but since it is equivalent, we know that we're not breaking the description of nature as a covariant theory.
Since the action gives a covariant equation of motion, therefore it is covariant, yeah. And therefore we don't need semicolons.
Yes, we could do any arbitrary transformation we like. So we choose to work with the time derivative because we have experience with that. We know what it does when we do the Legendre transform. We know that if we Legendre transform a theory that depends on some degree of freedom and its time derivative, then we will obtain a Hamiltonian formulation where the Hamiltonian is the generator of translations in time. This is what we want. If we did the Legendre transform with respect to a space derivative, for example, then we would get another H which would generate translations in the second space direction. So we want the H to generate the time evolution. Therefore, we choose this variable here and we do a Legendre transform with respect to it. So we are looking now for the canonically conjugate variable to the time derivative. We know what it would be ordinarily in quantum mechanics, the momentum, or in classical mechanics. So we are looking for the canonically conjugate momentum fields to phi. And for that purpose, we do the Legendre transform with respect to the time derivative. So we define a new variable, the canonically conjugate field to phi, as the functional derivative of the Lagrangian, this thing, which is like the action, but we drop the time integration. Functional derivative of that thing with respect to the time derivative of the field. This is dl by d phi dot. That's a new variable, and we do the Legendre transform. So before we actually carry out the Legendre transform, let's see what this variable is. What is the canonically conjugate field to phi? Remember what it was in Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, when we differentiated the L by the phi dot, the answer was phi dot. Because in Minkowski space, the Lagrangian is simply quadratic in phi dot, in the time derivative of phi. It starts out with the phi dot, 1/2 phi dot squared plus other stuff. Here it's not so easy. This is not just phi dot squared in here. So we should expect something more complicated. Let's do it. If we calculate the canonically conjugate field pi as the derivative of L with respect to phi dot, then you obtain this expression here. As you can even verify when you do it. See? In this sum over mu and mu, there's going to be a phi comma 0 occurring here and a phi comma 0 over there, both of which give you contribution when you do the functional derivative. That's the derivative of the factor 3 factor 1/2. And you end up with this. See, the g not mu, the 0 is there because this just picks out those terms in the sum of all mu and mu where you have a 0 either here or there, or both. Right. And this square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g would pick up from there. Okay, so this is the canonically conjugate momentum, general relativistically. And you can tell right away that this is not simply phi dot. In fact, it's a sum of different terms. Because here you're summing over all mu. If we were working on the Minkowski space, this g mu nu here would be diagonal, and the only contribution would come from the term where mu happens to be 0, in which case you have phi comma 0. And it's just phi dot again, up to this prefactor, which in Minkowski space would be 1. But now, in the more general setting, we have the sum of all mu. We get a contribution from phi dot, but perhaps surprisingly, there's also going to be contributions from space derivative. Right, so explicitly, this looks like that. The canonically conjugate momentum field is this contribution that looks more or less like what we would have expected, time derivative. That's from summing over all mu and taking the zero term, mu equals zero term. And here are the space derivatives. Now, what is important in this equation is that it will allow us to invert it. Here, we are expressing the new variable, namely pi, in terms of the old variables, namely phi dot and phi. But we're not really distinguishing between phi and its space derivatives here, because space is just a spectator thing. So we are expressing the new variable after the Schrödinger transform in terms of the old variables, phi dot, and some other things in terms of phi. But this is so nicely simple, linear in fact, that linear in phi that is, that we can actually invert it. We can throw this stuff on the other side, and that means we can express phi dot in terms of the new variables, which are pi and phi. That's important because in the Schrödinger transform, we will have to write that the Hamiltonian is the new variable times the old variable minus the Lagrangian. But when we write new variable times old variable, the old variable has to be expressed in terms of the new variables, if you remember. And that is what this equation allows us to do. So we are able to express the time derivative. This is phi comma 0, if you can't see from behind. This is not a new, this is a 0. We can express this phi comma 0 in terms of phi and pi, which are the new set of variables. Namely, the time derivative is the canonically conjugate momentum field divided by g naught naught, a determinant of g, minus those terms. So I've thrown this stuff on the left-hand side and divided everything by those two terms so that we get cleanly just phi dot. Let us call this equation V. V is the equation that expresses the time derivative in terms of the new variables pi and phi. So the Hamiltonian is now the integral over the new variables times the old variables, which we have to express in terms of the new variables, but we can do that using our equation phi, minus the Lagrangian, where the Lagrangian looks like this, but we have to express it in terms of the new variables. We have to express it in terms of phi and pi. In other words, phi dot should not occur in here. All occurrences of phi dot have to be replaced by that. By the way, you may wonder, why is it that when we integrate over the new variables times the old variables, we don't seem to need a square root of g factor? Ordinarily, you would expect there ought to be a square root of g factor to make the integral a covariant thing. Well, if you look at it, pi has built in such a factor in the definition of, or how pi came out. You see that pi already has a square root of g here and a square root of g there. So it's not a problem that this expression here doesn't have an extra square root of g. It's built into this. By the way, do you remember how that is called when a field such as pi has a square root of g built into it already? It's what is called a density. Phi is a scalar field. For example, phi is a scalar field, but pi is not a scalar field. Pi is a scalar density field because it is a scalar field times the square root of g. It's just a definition, and those of you who took my course last term should remember that. Now, as we already said, in H, we need to express all occurrences of the time derivative in terms of phi and pi, so that at the end of it, we obtain the Hamiltonian just as a function of phi, pi, and t. Well, and the space derivatives of phi, but we don't list them separately. I leave it to you as an exercise to carry this through, and then also to see how things simplify. Because it looks as if it were completely complicated. There are all occurrences of the time derivative and so on have to be replaced by this sum of four terms. But as it turns out, when you do it, the Hamiltonian is not that complicated. So what then are the equations of motion? We have the equations of motion already, of course, in the Lagrangian formulation. But now, how do the equations of motion look like now? In the Lagrangian formulation, it's just the Klein-Gordon equation, which is second order in time. In the Hamiltonian formulation, they're always first order in time. But the price you have to pay is that you get two equations of motion. So here, we obtain, as always after a Legendre transform, doesn't matter that now everything happens in general relativity, we are still carrying through the usual program of the Legendre transform. We know that the equations of motion, therefore, have to look like this now. D by dt of phi is dh by d pi, and d by dt of pi is minus dh by d phi. We proved that on general grounds before when we first studied the Legendre transform. But still, please check that when you write down those equations, you obtain the Klein-Gordon equation out of them. It's a bit non-trivial because the expressions are just a little longer. So we already moved from here to there now. Yep. That's right. Well, it's classical if you consider first quantization classical. You see, it's what we did is we took the Klein-Gordon equation, and the Klein-Gordon equation is first quantization. It is the relativistic version of the Schrödinger equation. Yes, as far as if you think of waves, the waves propagate classically. But of course, those waves are generalizations of wave functions. case. So far, this is first quantization in the sense that it is the Schrödinger equation or the Klein-Gödel equation, the Dirac equation, that sort of thing. And you're right. In principle, these are all wave equations that describe the classical propagation of waves. So the next step is to quantize those fields. Whereas phi and pi so far were just number-valued functions of space and time, they will now have to become operator-valued functions of space and time. And then once we've solved all of that, we can make predictions, and the Dyson-Schwinger equations will then show that they are completely equivalent with what we would obtain if we went Feynman's way, which does not involve at all any operators.
So, sir, classical field theory is nothing but first quantization?
Not in generality. In our case, yes, but you could think of the classical field theory of fluid motion or sound propagation. That would be classical fields, but they're not from first quantization.
But would you have a Klein-Gödel equation then, like for fluids?
Well, not really, because we don't have classical waves that would propagate in this way. Classical waves are always waves in the medium, and the medium has a rest frame, and that breaks Lorentz symmetry. So it wouldn't be the Klein-Gödel equation, it would be generalization. Although there are actually models, for example, of Bose-Einstein condensate, where you have a fluid equation, you have an equation of pressure waves in this fluid, which, even though they are bound to a medium, namely this Bose-Einstein condensate, have a propagation that can be described with what looks like a metric. And if you look at that metric, you can create situations in which that metric describes, in effect, a situation with curvature. So you can mimic things that are very reminiscent of general relativity also in condensed matter systems. In fact, this is a research program that has grown in the last few years. Namely, to try to study things such as the Hawking effect or the creation of particles through the expansion of space-time, not in the real world out there, in cosmology, looking at stars or so, where it is very hard to measure. It's very hard to measure Hawking radiation with an actual black hole because those things are so heavy, which makes them so cold. Hawking radiation is very cold then. But instead, to work with such a fluid analog, for example, in Bose-Einstein condensate, and then try to see Hawking radiation there. Try to create a circumstance in which this effective metric looks like that of a black hole, and then see if Hawking radiation is created. That is a program called emergent gravity.
Why in Bose-Einstein condensates?
Let me point you to some literature on this. It's not obvious why that would be so.
Because I've heard of that research program before, yes. And those, but I never. Okay.
Yeah. You see, you need a fluid in which you can quantize the phonons. If you take water, that's not very, that doesn't work very well. If you do it in a crystal, you have phonons, right? But in a crystal, you don't really have the ability to make non-trivial metrics occur. So we want to quantize our theory. We do have all the ingredients in principle. We have the Hamiltonian. We have the equations of motion. The equations of motion, remember, should always be the same as before, as classically or as in first quantization, except that we now put hats on everything. Fields that used to be real number valued should become Hermitian operator, self-adjoint operator valued. Well, and the biggest change is the commutation relation. We want phi to commute among themselves and pi to commute among themselves. And between phi and pi, we want this commutation relation. We will summarize the three simply by saying these are the CCRs. Now that equation, or all of the three of the equations in general relativity, require a little bit more than in Minkowski space. See, these are equal time commutation relations. There's an x, and there's an x prime here, so the phi is at a different position than is the pi, but the time is the same. In general relativity, time is relative. So you could choose, you have a lot of choices in declaring points, events as being equal time. In space-time, you can slice in many different ways into space-like hypersurfaces. So you can make space-time into a sandwich where each layer is another point in time in many different ways. You can choose wavy layers or more flat layers. And it will be highly non-trivial to show that if you choose a space-like hypersurface, any one, in fact, because which one should we prefer? If you choose any space-like hypersurface and you impose those commutation relations on it, that, first of all, the result does not depend on which space-like hypersurface you've chosen. And secondly, that they are going to be preserved in time. That the commutation relations, if holding at one time, will, through the evolution of the Klein-Gödel equation of the phi and the pi, will not destroy the commutation relations. And magically, this all works out. But a priori, it doesn't look obvious that this would work out. So in order to solve the quantum field theory, and that's just the free quantum field theory, I've dropped at the moment any potential. So there's no phi to the third or phi to the fourth term. We allow a phi squared term, m squared phi squared, just to allow that the particles have a mass. But we drop the potential for now to keep the Klein-Gödel equation simpler and linear. In order to solve that theory, we have to make sure that three things are okay, and only three things. And they are, first of all, the commutation relations. They must hold for all time, and it should not matter on which space-like hypersurface you first enforced them. And secondly, we need to ensure that we have hermeticity, since phi, before the second quantization, was a real-valued field. It ought to be, after the second quantization, a self-adjoint operator valued field. And similarly for the canonically conjugate momentum field. And these two equations we will abbreviate as HC. I took out some slides. I took out some slides this morning, and they were before this, where the lambda played a role. Yep. I'll explain in a moment why I did these changes. Okay, so we will want hermeticity to ensure that the expectation values are real. Okay, so, and the third thing, after the commutation relations and hermeticity, is of course that the equations of motion should hold. I will also put an appendix, or I have already put an appendix to those lecture notes, and the appendix is what I cut out. Okay, I put it in an appendix. It's a review of why we choose the commutation relations the way we choose them. It's just a review of the general quantization procedure, showing that it works independently of whether this is classical mechanics or quantum field theory in Minkowski space or quantum field theory in general relativity. So I'm referring that to the appendix now, because I think that this review maybe distracts a little bit from the main purpose, which is to solve the equations of motion, the commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions. This is the main goal now. And the upshot of all of this in the appendix is simply that, yeah, well, the commutation relations that I wrote down are the correct ones. We should impose those. So it's just a more detailed justification of why that is what we want to do. So the equations of motion are these in the Hamiltonian formulation. They are the Klein-Gordon equation, well, no wonder, because it held in the Lagrangian formulation already, and the equation that relates the canonically conjugate momentum to the time derivative of the field. In principle, the two equations are, well, you can rewrite them also differently, so that you have the time derivative of pi and the time derivative of phi. This would be the Hamiltonian equations initially, but they're completely equivalent to those two equations of motion. So let's see, what do we have to solve in order to be able to say we solved the quantum field theory? Hermeticity condition, canonical commutation relations, and the equations of motion. Surprisingly, perhaps, it's the commutation relations that are the hardest. It's not the equations of motion. And the reason is that the equations of motion, as it turns out, to solve them boils down to solving it classically, which is not so hard, because you can always do that numerically, because it's just a scalar differential equation. It's a partial differential equation, and a principle that can always be done. So how do we solve the canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity conditions, and the equations of motion? Here's the strategy. Let's try an answer which ensures the hermeticity by construction. So we write down an answer, as we did before in Minkowski space, which makes sure that the phi and the pi come out Hermitian and there's no worry about it, just to get this out of the way. And then secondly, we make an ansatz that separates the problem of solving the canonical commutation relations, that separates the non-commutativity business from the equations of motion problem, which is all about time evolution, so that we can solve one thing separate from the other. And here is an ansatz that achieves these things. Namely, we will try to solve our problem here by writing the phi hat of x and t as the sum of some number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, uk of x and t times an operator ak plus the Hermitian conjugate. So this is the complex conjugate version of that function, and that is just the Hermitian conjugate operator of this one, where these we will ask to obey the usual commutation relations between annihilation and creation operators. We know that this sort of thing worked in Minkowski space, so maybe it will work again. Hermeticity is obvious because this thing is the Hermitian conjugate of that thing, so therefore if you take the Hermitian conjugate of the whole, well, you obtain easily that phi dagger is phi. And pi hat is, of course, by construction, this. This is what it's got to be. It's one of the equations of motion. This, at this stage, is a definition. It's an ansatz for what might solve our problem. And by virtue of making this ansatz, we are making sure that the hermeticity condition is OK right away for both phi and pi. And by virtue of making that definition, we make sure that one of the equations of motion is OK right away by construction, because this is one of the equations of motion. But let's see what we have to require of those functions uk and those operators ak. Well, obviously, we would want that these things simply have the usual commutation. Namely, those. You see, if we get away with this ansatz, we're really done because we know how to build a Hilbert space from those operators. We take a vector that's annihilated by the A, and then we act with powers of A dagger and build up orthogonal vectors, and in this way we can build up an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. Well, and those U, those functions U, we hope we can choose number valued, because then it won't screw up the non-commutativity of those. If we choose those things number valued in the right way, maybe the answer works. Let's see. So let's see how this ansatz fares. Check of the hermeticity. Well, hermeticity is okay by construction. We clarified that already. What about the first equation of Morph? With this ansatz, are we sure that the Klein-Gordon equation is going to hold for the operator valued field? Yes, we are sure, because remember, we said that the UK will be chosen among the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. As long as we stick to this in our ansatz, we should be fine. In fact, we don't even need a sum for that. Just choose one complex valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation and plug it into here, and you get a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation times an operator, which is constant after all. It's a big matrix, if you like, when you choose a basis. It has no time dependence. So as far as the time evolution is concerned, it's just a constant. So you have a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation times a constant plus a solution times a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation times a constant. Well, the sum of two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation is still a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, as long as you don't have a potential. So therefore, this thing is actually going to be a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, even if we just have one single solution to the Klein-Gordon equation here, single number valued solution. That looks great. It looks like we are in business here, right? Just find any classical solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, plug it into this, and get the quantum solution. So why would we even bother summing these things? AK is a constant. AK is a constant operator. Sorry, what?
Multiplying the solution, not
adding
the solution.
No, multiplying, yes. If you have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, you multiply it with 27, still a solution. Yes. And if you multiply it with AK, it's still a solution. It's a matrix, and you can think of every matrix element being a solution. And the Klein-Gordon equation is diagonal. It's the Klein-Gordon operator, the Dannenberg operator is like the identity matrix as far as this is concerned. So how about the second equation of motion? This was the first equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation. The second equation of motion holds trivially because it was a definition, right? This one. Okay, so it looks like it's all pretty easy. As soon as you have a classical solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, you get a quantum solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Just multiply with an A and add the Hermitian conjugate like that, and you have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And the hermeticity condition also holds, and the second equation of motion also holds. So there must be a reason why we have a sum here. Why would it be that we actually need perhaps several of those solutions there? In fact, sometimes we may want an integral over here. I wrote a sum because then we don't have to worry about integral methods. If you put a suitable infrared cutoff, ultraviolet cutoff, and so on, then you can always arrange this to be a sum. But keep in mind that in Minkowski space, if you don't put the thing into a box, then the equivalent expression here was an integral. And then we put it in a box and it became a sum. Sum of a mode function. So why is it that we have multiple solutions here? Why do we need that? So far it doesn't look like we need it. Well, it's we find out that we need that when we check the canonical commutation relation. This is the price. We need to solve this equation here. The phi phi equation with the pi pi equation is totally straightforward. This is a non-trivial thing here. So how can we ensure that this equation holds? Let's see what the condition is. What condition may we have to pose on those classical solutions, on those so-called mode functions? These guys are called mode functions. What condition do we have to put on those mode functions such that this ansatz here solves the canonical commutation relation? Let's see. In this equation here, phi is given by the ansatz, and pi is also given by the ansatz, namely, you know, this is the canonically conjugate momentum field expressed in terms of phi. So all we have to do is take this equation and plug our ansatz into it, namely this expression for phi and that expression for pi, work out this commutator, and see what this equation then means for the u. The thing is that in when I previously taught this course, I handled this issue the same way that it is handled in literally all of the textbooks that I have or got my hands on, which is not to handle it at all, which is really a pity. Usually it's just handled in, you know, in the special simple cases like Friedman-Robertson-Walter expanding spacetimes or Minkowski space or so. But I didn't find it anywhere really spelled out explicitly. If you find literature anywhere where this is spelled out explicitly, show me. I spent last night several hours finding literature on this issue, which you would think is a key issue, right? But I couldn't find it. So I just made it up on this morning. And please check that I'm not making any sign errors or stuff like that. I mean, the bits and pieces you find in the literature, but I haven't seen it actually done in a logical way. So it's straightforward, right? We plug the ansatz, this and that, into here. And then what do we have? The canonically conjugate momentum field is this long expression. Once you write it out using the ansatz, you see it's this, of course, but the phi is expressed in this way using the ansatz, using, you know, the mode functions and the equation and the relation operators. So all we have to do is check the canonical commutation relation. For phi, we plug in our ansatz for phi. And for pi, we plug in this longer expression that we just had, this one. Right? This expression is over here. And then we work out what this commutator is. And we have to enforce that it is I times delta function of x minus x prime. So what do we get? What sort of terms will occur? We have a sum over k here, over all the modes. Here we have a sum over k prime, again, all the modes. Here we have terms proportional to A, proportional to A dagger. Same here, terms proportional to A, proportional to A dagger. We have to take the commutator between this stuff and that. The commutator will pick up two contributions. Namely, whenever we have a term of that kind, commuting with a term of this kind. See, here we have an A, and here we have an A dagger. Here we have an AK. And here we have an a k prime. Sorry, there are lots of primes missing. This is the sort of thing where I need some help to spot it. With the k prime.
So the commutator of this with that will give us a contribution, and also the commutator of this with this first term he gives us a contribution, because here the A dagger is not commuting with the A. The commutator between AK and A dagger K prime is the Kronecker delta of K and K prime. So even though we have a double sum over K and K prime here, in the next line, we can in principle reduce this to a single sum because we have the Kronecker delta occurring whenever we do commute the A with the A dagger. Actually, in the next line, I'm still keeping that Kronecker delta, but now you see where it's coming from. It's when you have the commutator between this A and this A dagger, and here as well. So you get two terms, and they are these.
You also have a discrepancy between the primes. The first line, you have the prime on the right-hand side. The next line, you have the prime in the X, I mean, on the left-hand side. Is that what I'm
saying?
In the commutator, you have the X prime being in the pi.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. It should be the other way around. I should have first written it on paper before I wrote it there. Yes, that's right. What to do now? I suppose the easiest is to just turn around those two. Like that. But I'll have to verify this at the end. All right, so this is, yes, you're right. This now depends on x prime, and this depends on x. So pi. Okay. Right, so now we get two terms. You see, this has a u, okay, and this picks up a non-commuting thing with that, where here we have a d by dx of u star. So that gives us, see, here it's the other way around.
The G.
Yeah, here it should be the prime here and no prime there. Yeah, that's how it is, but we just have to fix it, I suppose. All right, then. And
the G
as well, they should not have a prime now, that's right. Okay. And so that has not the ordinary prime, this one has a prime, that one has a prime. Agreed? So.
And the dx's should be unprime, right? I can't see very, very well there.
Should
one of these.
Yes, the derivative shouldn't have, right?
Yeah,
that's the point, yes. Yeah. Right?
And you need to prime the k's in that.
Prime the k's. No, I don't, because there's a Kronecker delta there.
You haven't done that yet. So
I know. Wait, do you mean?
In the third line, you're still summing over it.
Yes, well, that's right. Which one is it? Which one needs the prime now? Those guys need it, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, God. This gets a prime, right? And that gets a prime. Yeah, that's because I'm using the prime sum here, but the primed x over there. There you go, some sort of gymnastics. Okay. All right, so then we get rid of this, and we get the single sum over these terms, where the primes are wrong. So, yeah, but never mind, not so bad. So this and that. Here's the prime, there's the prime. Okay, so we need, this is what the commutator between phi and pi is, using our answers. And that has to be this. And now you see why It's not going to work, our ansatz, if we use only one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. Because if we just use one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then we would have a function times the derivative of a function minus a function times the derivative of a function. That's supposed to be a delta distribution, which it's not going to be. So what the only chance we have is that we take infinitely many of those, because if we sum over infinitely many of those, we might just end up with a distribution. Just like when you take a plane wave, and then another plane wave, each of which is a regular function, and you sum them all up, you can actually get a representation of the delta function. This is exactly what happens, as we will see in a moment, in Minkowski space, where you take plane wave mode functions, and you sum over all of them, and you can actually generate a delta function in this way. That's just Fourier. But of course, on a generic curved space, we cannot expect anything like Fourier. Fourier transform is not the covariant thing to do. So therefore, it looks pretty hopeless. I mean, how do we know that this will ever work outside Minkowski space, or perhaps on the flat space time that's expanding? Then we might still get away with it there, because as long as the space is flat, we at least have Fourier transform. So maybe we can get away with some sort of plane wave ansatz like we did in Minkowski space, and then end up getting another distribution here. And remember that if we do achieve that, if we find a set of functions u, k of x and t that solve the Klein-Gordon equation and have this property that this terrible sum here gives us the delta distribution, then we're done. We've actually solved the quantum field theory, because the rest is taken care of. We've already taken care of the equations of motion, taken care of permitticity. And if only we can achieve that, then we have also solved the Klein-Gordon, the canonical commutation relations, so we're done. Well, there's still a little matter of checking to be done. Like, we impose this only at one time. We really have to impose it at all. So things actually look a little bit harder even, because it doesn't suffice to find a set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation for which this holds true at one time. Got to hold true at all times.
But because it is equal commutative time, therefore it should hold at all times.
No, why would that be so? It's a condition that holds at one time. A condition that holds at one time doesn't have reason to hold at all times, in general. But as it will turn out, it in fact suffices because of the nature of the Klein-Gordon equation to ensure this at one point in time.
Because when we consider phi and pi, we are considering phi and pi both at the same time.
We are looking at equal time commutation relations, which means we are looking at the commutation relations for different points in space at one point in time. If those commutation relations hold at one point in time, we still have to show that they will automatically also hold at later time. We still have to show that the equations of motion do not lead us away from that equation, that it's going to be preserved. Now, as it turns out, this equation, as ugly as it may look, is ultimately something that we may know from other contexts. On the one hand, as far as the theory of partial differential equations is concerned, this is what is called a Wronskian. And Wronskians are conserved in time. We will get to that. Secondly, from a functional analytic point of view, it will turn out that this is simply a resolution of the identity in the function space. In the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, this is the resolution of the identity, as you may know it from quantum mechanics. If you have an orthonormal basis in your Hilbert space, then you can write down a resolution of the identity. You can write down something like, see, if the n are an orthonormal basis, then the sum over all n is the identity operator. Ultimately, this equation is of that form. And this sum is, in fact, such a sum
And the identity operator is this. You see, this is the identity operator at an integral, up to the minus sign, up to the I. This is the identity operator under the integral. Because if you multiply it with a function, integrate over x prime, you get the same function back. So it's an identity, and this is a resolution of the identity in the Hilbert space, in the Hilbert space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. Remember that we don't even have to look at general functions in K. They have to at least be solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. So we can restrict attention to solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. So now let us see what our conclusion is. Our answers, namely that we solve the theory in this way, we'll solve the quantum field theory, we'll solve the hermeticity conditions, the equations of motion, and the commutation relations, if only we can find a set of number-valued functions, un of x and t, which solve the Klein-Gödel equation, and which solve this equation here. I just rewrote what we had up there, right? This resolution of the identity. Let's call it RI for resolution of the identity. But how do we know that this is even possible? I mean, it could very well be that our answers only works in trivial cases. For example, because Fourier theory is available. So when do such functions, uk of x and t, solutions to the Klein-Gödel equations, actually exist? When is there such a set of functions that this RI expression really sums up to give us the delta function? Now here's a proposition. Assume that space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic, which is to say that it is topologically of the form of a real line times some other Riemannian manifold, some other manifold. So the real line for the time coordinate, and then spatially, it could be something complicated. For example, cosmological space-time. In this case, the answer will work. First of all, in this case, space-time possesses no closed time-like curves. And obviously, that would be a nasty situation if we had closed time-like curves. So there's no travel into the past. It's a pretty reasonable assumption that space-time is globally hyperbolic. Technically, it means that it suffices to put initial conditions on classical fields, on fields that number-valued functions that obey the Klein-Gödel equation. If you put initial conditions on one space-like hypersurface, which is to say at one time, then that determines the evolution for all of the future, and in fact also all of the past. So we assume that there are Cauchy surfaces. Cauchy surfaces are space-like hypersurfaces on which you can put initial conditions, that is to say the field that is time derivative, and that will then uniquely determine the solution. You will determine uniquely what the field will do in our future if you require the Klein-Gödel equation. So the proposition now is that at least, maybe in other cases too, but at least when space-time is globally hyperbolic, then such a set of functions uk, such a set of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equations can indeed be found such that this answer over there will work. Unfortunately, the proposition doesn't tell us how to find that set of solutions, but it does guarantee that there is such a set of solutions. So the claim is that at least when space-time is globally hyperbolic, the answers will work. Now the proof works like this. Let me start with the proof strategy. First of all, we will study the space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. It's a linear space. It's a vector space. Because if you have one solution to the Klein-Gödel equation and another one, the sum of the two is also going to be a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation. And if you multiply the solution to the Klein-Gödel equation with 27, it's still a solution. So it's a vector space. Let us study that vector space. After all, we know that those mode functions uk, if they exist at all, obeying our RI equation, they have to come from the space of solution. So we look at the vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then what we'd like to do is define a Hermitian form on it. Or you may know it from a different perspective, namely a self-adjoint operator. If you have two functions f and q g, then this defines for us that this is a self-adjoint operator. Then this defines for us a Hermitian form, f, g. So you take two functions of your vector space, f and g, or two elements of your vector space, doesn't have to be function space. You take two vectors, f and g, and you obtain what is called a Hermitian form when you take the two vectors in your Hilbert space and you act as a self-adjoint operator on one of them and then calculate the inner product. So if this thing is Hermitian, then what you define in this way is a Hermitian form. So nothing deep there. But the point is that if we achieve that, if we can define a Hermitian form on it, we can define such a Hermitian inner product on it, such a self-adjoint operator here, then we know that because this thing is self-adjoint, we can diagonalize it. We can diagonalize it, and we obtain an eigenbasis of Q, which is on general functional analytic grounds, a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. So it is a complete orthonormal basis, which we can use to write down this. Okay, and that will be the equation that you want to show. That will be the RI equation. There's a little bit extra that we need to prove that our answer succeeds in getting the commutation relations right. Okay, so this is the overall strategy. We study the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then our aim is to define on it a Hermitian form, which is to say a self-adjoint operator. Then we diagonalize that self-adjoint operator, which will be actually very easy. And then we obtain, we can read off what its eigenbasis is going to be. That gives us a Hilbert basis. They are going to be the UN. They're going to be the mode functions. And then we can show that when we write down a resolution of the identity in the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, that resolution of the identity is exactly the equation that we have to prove. All right, so we start with studying the space of the vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Here's the vector space, we call it V, let's say, of all real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember that the Klein-Gordon equation is a real equation, it's a real differential equation. There's no I occurring anywhere in this, and the D'Alembert operator is Hermitian. That guarantees that you can find you can span the solution space completely with just really valued functions. So you're not missing any solutions by just looking at the really valued solutions. Later we will complexify that and look also at complex linear combinations of really valued solutions, but we can restrict attention to start with for our analysis just to the really valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We know this span a vector space, a real vector space, and that vector space we call V. Now we define a bilinear form on V. What is a bilinear form? Well, it's something where you can plug in two vectors and you get out a number in a linear fashion in both arguments. That is what a bilinear form is. So if F and G are elements of our vector space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then we define the bilinear form, which we denote by round brackets, as the integral over a space-like hypersurface. If you choose coordinates, you can choose the surface of constant t, for example, for a fixed value of t. We define this bilinear form for two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation to be the integral over some space-like hypersurface of this expression here. Now, what do we have here? We have this integral measure here. We have g mu nu. And here we have f d mu g minus g d mu f. And this index mu is contracted with a sigma mu, where sigma mu is a vector pointing outwards from its orthogonal to the surface, to the space-like hypersurface. You may have, hopefully you have seen integrals of that kind, where you integrate a vector over a surface. For example, when you have a current in electromagnetism, you have a current and you integrate how much current is flowing out of a surface. That's the integral that you would have here. And in fact, as we will later see, this is a current. In fact, it is a conserved current, mathematically speaking, not electromagnetically speaking, but mathematically it is. Anyway, so we define this thing, and you may wonder, why on earth would we define that? Why would we define it like this? Why a minus sign? Shouldn't we put a plus sign to make things simpler, perhaps? Or just take one of the terms, or something like this? The answer is that this is completely fixed. This shape is completely fixed by the following requirement. The outcome shouldn't depend on what space-like hypersurface you choose, because otherwise it's pretty pointless. Remember, we want to be able to enforce the equal time commutation relations on one space-like hypersurface, but we want to be sure that it doesn't matter which space-like hypersurface we choose, because it should ensure that it holds in all space-like hypersurfaces. So here are the properties that determine this precise shape. First of all, property one, it ought to be well-defined, which is to say that the number that you get, after all, this is just a number, something like 5 or 7. That number should not depend on the space-like hypersurface on which you calculate it. Remember, f is a scalar function of space and time. G is a scalar function of space and time. Here you calculate the space derivatives. And you take the metric, you integrate this whole thing over a surface. And at the end of it, you get a number. And that should not depend on the surface on which you calculated it. We will later show that this is the case. And we'll postpone that, but I will put it in the notes, and I will also explain to you next time. But I hope that some of you may venture to prove this, because if you've at least if you're taking my course last term, you should have the mathematical tools to prove this, that this is independent of the space-like hypersurface on which you evaluate, only on the basis of knowing that the f and the g both obey the Klein-Gödel. Okay, so the key property that determines that we should define it in this way is that it should be independent of the choice of space-like hypersurface, something whose proof we will postpone. But let me point out already that this proof requires there to be a minus sign. We can't get around it. And I'm pointing this out because later on we will wish that there is a plus sign, but there has to be a minus sign. Okay, so secondly, and that is when the minus sign first pops up, we notice that this thing is a bilinear form of the type that is called a symplectic form. It is anti-symmetric. This thing has the property that fg is minus gf, obviously, right? If you switch around f and g, you just pick up a minus sign. Now, this is a pity, because if you keep in mind the program, if you keep in mind our strategy, we want to get a resolution of the identity, right? But this seems to be in our way. See, if this thing were symmetric, then it would mean that we have some Hermitian form, that we have a Hermitian bilinear form, that we have a Savitzer operator underlying. And that would mean, oh yeah, nice, there is a basis of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, which diagonalizes this Hermitian form, which is to say that it diagonalizes this Savitzer operator. And well, once we have this diagonalizing basis, we can write down a resolution of the identity. But our plan seemed to be running in trouble here because this is a negative sign here. So what to do? Well, but this is just to say again what I indicated on the blackboard as well. If it were symmetric, or if this is symmetric, or even better, if it were Hermitian, so if FG is GF star, then we could view this as arising from a self-adjoint operator here, F and G, and there's a Q self-adjoint operator, which we could then diagonalize. We get an eigenbasis and a resolution dead end. However, not everything is lost here. In fact, we can pull out of it. We can do something interesting with this bilinear form. We can't diagonalize it, because it's not a Hermitian form. But there's a theorem by Dabu. And that tells us that we can do something which is nearly as good as diagonalizing it. Namely, it says that for any symplectic bilinear form, there exists a basis Vn such that in this basis, our bilinear form takes this shape. Come, you see how that works. It is a matrix that is nearly diagonal, but instead of being diagonal, it has lots of little sub-matrices which look like this. So it's 0, 0, 1, minus 1, and then another one of those sub-matrices, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. This is what you have on the diagonal. And the rest of the matrix is 0. Which means that there is a basis of pairs of vectors, so that for each pair, the this anti-symmetric bilinear form looks like that in that basis, if we take that pair as a basis. So that means that if we, and so that means that there is a basis of vectors in the solution space to the Klein-Gödel equation, such that the vectors v index 2n and v index 2n plus 1, so we take an even index and then the next one, which would be now just plus 1. So I'm just grouping the pairs of vectors now as a vector, let's say, v6 and v7 is a pair. And then v8 and v9 is a pair, and so on. And for each pair, you get one of those 2x2 matrices. And other than that, it's all vector diagonal. So there is a basis in our vector space of solution to the Klein-Gödel equation such that the vn and the vn plus 2, vn plus v2n plus 1, when you evaluate them in the bilinear form, you get one. That's this one here, or that one. And if you take the vn plus 1 and v2n, do it the other way around, then you get a minus 1. That's this. Those are these matrix elements over here. And all other pairings vanish. So the bilinear form gives us a 0 if we plug in an arbitrary basis vector vn and another basis vector that is not the one that is paired with this one. Or to write it out completely explicitly, these guys form a basis of the solution space, capital V. So any arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, A or B, any such solution, for example, A, can be expanded with real coefficients as AN times VN. So the VN is this basis of solutions, and here we have coefficients AN. Another arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, B, is also expandable in the basis of the Vn with coefficients Bn that are real number value. So this is in capital V, the space of solutions. That is in the space of solutions. These are just coefficients with respect to the spaces vectors. Then the bilinear form, our symplectic form, when fed the two solutions A and B, spits out the following number, this one, where these are the coefficients a n and b n occurring here.
So
So are we working in a real vector space or a
process
vector space?
So far, everything is real.
Okay.
Everything is real. But you're asking at the right time, because now we're going to complexes, right? So now let's assume we pick such a basis Vn. It didn't seem very useful so far, because we need something completely different. We need a diagonalization. So we know that those guys are solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, and we know that in that basis that they constitute, in that basis, this inner product takes this simple form. But let us keep the goal in mind here. We will need a Hermitian form, not a symplectic one. We need a Hermitian form so that we can then get diagonalization in the corresponding orthonormal basis and the resolution of the identity. On the other hand, we know that, as always in quantum theory, we are likely to need complex solutions, complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. Now, since the Klein-Gödel equation is a real equation, there are complex solutions, but they're always just a linear combination of real ones. So it's easy to go to the complexification of that solution space. Simply allow all complex linear combinations of the real valued solutions. That will give you the space of all complex valued solutions. So maybe the two things go hand in hand. Maybe if we go to the complexified solution space, maybe then we will get a handle on defining Hermitian form. And that is actually what happens. So let's see. What happens when we complexify the space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation? So we look at the complex vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, which we may denote by V bar. The set of complex linear combinations of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. What would be a basis? Well, we can easily write down a basis of that space V bar. Namely, let us define functions un, which are going to be complex valued. We take v2n minus I v2n plus 1. So we take a pair of real valued solutions and we just add them. We take one as the real part and then minus I times the other, so that gives us an imaginary part. So this is definitely a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, because this is, that is, it's just a linear addition, but it's a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gödel equation. And the complex conjugate is also going to be a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation. Overall, we get the same number of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, because for each pair of, subtracted pair of real valued solutions, we get pair of complex valued solutions. And it turns out those are going to be our UN. Those are going to be our mode functions. But to see this, we'll see what happens to this bilinear form. Now it turns out, and I leave it to you as an exercise to verify this, that the bilinear form for the real valued solutions implies this bilinear form for the complex valued solutions. So if F and G are elements of V bar, then we can define a new bilinear form with this square bracket here. This is not quantum mechanics, right? This is just another bilinear form here. So you plug in two solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, and then when you define this bilinear form, then the bilinear form that we had already for the real valued solutions gives us that as the values that the bilinear form, the new bilinear form takes for the complex valued solution. The whole point about this is that this thing is a Hermitian form. This thing is Hermitian. It has the property that, and I should really have written that on the slide, but it has the property that if you take F G, it is G F complex conjugate. Which means that underlying all of that is a self-adjoint operator. Because basically it means that in some Hilbert space you can view it as F Q G, sorry, G. Because that would have this property, right? If you think about it, this is ordinary Hilbert space inner product, and that's this Hilbert-joint operator, then that is, see, this is, if you put it like that, it's a G F Q star. Okay? So this thing is a Hermitian form. Underlying is a self-adjoint operator. And it turns out that we are getting its diagonalization for free. We get the eigenfunctions, the eigenvectors to Q right away because they are our UN. It turns out that the UN have the Kronecker delta and the UN stars, which by the way are linearly independent solutions. Right? You can't just take those UN and linearly combine the UN stars. You usually have to complex conjugate them. So you have that these solutions have that value for the inner product, and those solutions have that value for the inner product, and you have minus Kronecker delta NM. And other than that, they are orthogonal, which means that the underlying operator Q for this Hermitian form is simply the operator which is 1 for a long while on the diagonal, and then minus 1 for a long while. It's 1 on the diagonal for all the UN, and it's minus 1 on the diagonal for all the UN star. That's the self-adjoint operator there, because it corresponds to this Hermitian form, and those are the eigenvectors. The important thing being that they, since they are eigenvectors to a self-adjoint operator, form an orthonormal basis. They form a Hilbert basis of our Hilbert space, which means Hilbert, to be precise, they form an orthonormal eigenbasis of the Hilbert space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, equipped with this inner product, here. Okay. So that means that, since these guys are an orthonormal basis of the complexified space of solutions, the space of complex solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, we can write that the identity operator is the sum over all those plus the sum of all those, because together they form this basis. Those are the ones with eigenvalue 1, those are the ones with eigenvalue minus 1. And so that we have, in particular, that if we apply this to an arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, complex solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, then we just apply that to the right of this equation, and we obtain that if you put the f over here and over there, so you multiply it from the right, you have this entire operator acting on f, then you obtain this. And it is f, because it's one active. This, it turns out, is our equation Ri. And how do you prove that? Well, it's an exercise for you to do this. Just have to keep in mind that when you write this thing out, remember, this sum over n is that sum over k. This here is an inner product between two complex solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. And what is that inner product? Right? You can work that out using the definition of what that inner product is. And then you end up with this expression here. So unfortunately, we are out of time. We will continue with this. The next item we do is that we go through the whole thing again, but for the simple case of Minkowski space, so that you see what the individual things are there. I mean, what are the UN for Minkowski space? And then show that this is really true for Minkowski space. Where in this case, you can anticipate how it works. You get plane waves summing all up in a Fourier way to get the delta function.